let's pick up where we left off in the book of Daniel. We left off in chapter 7. This chapter 7, if we were going to put it in chronological order, it actually should have probably been put between chapter 5 and 6, simply because when Daniel has this particular vision that he's going to be talking about tonight, he had it during one of the first years of Belshazzar. And we've already read that Belshazzar, you know, met his Waterloo when the Medes and the Persians overtook Babylon, and he was killed. So chronologically, this should be placed a chapter or two before what it is here. But the reason it is placed here, I believe, is because now we're getting into the prophetic part of the book, and so much of what has to deal with the future and upcoming events. And usually Daniel has been the interpreter of various dreams up to this point, but now Daniel himself begins to have a dream, and he has a dream about the future. Now, a couple of things I want you to keep in mind. What Daniel's dream involves, it involves basically the same kind of theme that Nebuchadnezzar's dream dealt with in terms of the huge stature of a man. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar had this dream of this huge stature of a man, if you remember, in his dream, he dreamt that there was a head of gold, which was interpreted to be Babylon. And then he dreamt that there was the arms and the chest of silver, which was portrayed as being the Medes and the Persians. And then there was the belly and the thighs of bronze, which was portrayed as being Greece. And then the legs of iron, which was Rome. And then finally, the final kingdom would be the feet of mixed iron and clay, which will be the end time world conglomeration of our world power that's going to be headed by the Antichrist. Now, what's interesting is that Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, but it's the same dream that Daniel's going to be telling in his chapter 7, but they're totally different symbolisms. And I think it's kind of significant because we are told in 2 Corinthians, I believe, or 1 Corinthians chapter 2, rather, that the natural mind cannot understand the things of God, and the natural mind is opposed to the things of God, and they can't comprehend it. But the spiritual man has a totally different viewpoint of life and everything that involves spiritual matters. And what I'm trying to drive out here is that to the natural man, this huge stature of a man is something glorious. It's something to look up to. It's something that's really splendid. What it represents is all the human governments of the world that man thinks is so great. But from God's perspective, these human governments, these human agencies, these world powers, really represent beasts. It's interesting that in Daniel's vision, he sees Jesus Christ as a stone, where Nebuchadnezzar sees the huge stature of a man as being something so glorious that he, in the following chapter, even erects a huge stature of a man, 60 cubits high, and 6 cubits in depth and in width. And he made it all of gold, and he demanded everybody to worship it, because he just views this as being great, when God looks at a totally different perspective. Just keep that in mind as we begin to read this chapter 7. It says here in verse 1 of chapter 7 in Daniel, it says, "The first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed, and then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, 'I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. And I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, "Arise and devour much meat." After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, the fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boast. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat, and his vesture was like white wool, and the hair of his head was pure wool, and the throne was ablaze with flames, and its wheels were burning fire, and a river of fire was flowing, and coming from out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were open. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking, and I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days, and it was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all the peoples of the nations of men in every language might serve him. His dominion was an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Okay, going back to the first verse of chapter 7, it says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay in his bed when he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Like I said, this is during the reign of the first year of King Belshazzar's reign. So like I said, chronologically, this chapter probably should be between 5 and 6. Okay, it says in verse 2, it says, Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Now, here's the symbolism. This is very rich in symbolism. It's powerful in symbolism. But the Bible is its own best commentary. We don't have to go to other sources to try to figure out what he's talking about here, because the Bible makes it abundantly clear through other points in Scripture, other chapters, other verses, other books, what these symbolisms stand for. It says here, he was looking in his visions by night. The very fact that it's by night is very suggestive to me, because the Bible always talks about light and darkness, okay, about the powers of darkness. And he's looking at night. In other words, he's looking at a very, very dark point in world history. But not only that, it's because the forces of darkness are really ruling this world. And we are in night spiritually. We are in darkness spiritually. The world is engrossed in darkness. Okay, it won't be until Christ comes back and sets up his millennial kingdom that will be finally, the whole world will be, bathed in light. And people will see the truth. But right now, the world is bathed in darkness, and people are stumbling in so much error and so much falsehood. And they're, following all kinds of different, pathways that lead to destruction. So he says, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Now here again, sometimes the Bible refers to wind as the Holy Spirit. But other places we can see that the devil he is the prince of the power of air. So put it in the proper context, I really believe when he talks about the four winds of heaven. Now what he's referring to is, all over the globe, north, south, east, and west, there are spiritual forces that are moving. You can't see them. You can't see the wind, but you can see evidence of the wind. If you're out there, you can feel it on you. If you're out there, you can see it blowing trees around. You can see it blowing things around. You can't see the wind, but you can see the effect of the wind. We are living in a day and age where we can't see these demonic forces, but we can certainly see the effects of their work, can't we? I mean, it's all over the place. We can see what monsters of iniquity these creatures really are. They are intent on the utter destruction of mankind and the blasphemy of God and the damnation of as many souls as possible. They are working behind the scenes. We cannot see them, but they are working north, south, east, and west. These are the four winds of the four corners of the earth, so to speak. And they are stirring up all of the things that are happening in our world today. They are stirring. They are the ones that are behind it. People don't see this. They think that we have a war on terrorism, and then bin Laden is the big monster of iniquity that we have to cut off his head, and that'll be the end of this. No, what's really behind bin Laden is the spiritual forces of wickedness that are driving men to kill one another with the sword and to destroy one another and to destroy the earth. That's what's really behind what's going on here. So when he says, I see, behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. This is very significant because, again, the Bible is its own best commentary. In the book of Isaiah, we are told that the wicked are like the restless sea. They are always up stirring up muck and mire and filth and whatnot. And, you know, it's interesting, especially if you look at the news broadcast or you look at the paper and you see pictures of masses and masses of people protesting all stirred up and you see them. It looks like a massive sea, doesn't it? Well, this is what he's talking about. You look all around the globe and you see masses of humanity in a constant turmoil. They are restless. It's totally contrasted to what John saw when he saw in the book of Revelation a sea that was like a sea of glass before the throne of God. That represented symbolically all the multitudes of people standing before God that are quiet, that are still, that are at peace, that have total joy. Total contrast to what's going on in the world today or to the earth, where you see enormous upheavals of multitudes upon multitudes of people who are either protesting or they're demanding their rights, quote unquote, or they are threatening, or they are they're carrying on and on and on. And I don't care whether it's in Berkeley, California, or it's over there in the Middle East. I mean, this is what's happening. People are just like the restless sea. People are killing one another. The really sad thing is when they start blowing themselves up and killing as many people as they can in the name of God. I mean, this is really a restless sea, isn't it? So what Daniel's referring to here is he's seeing in all this spiritual darkness, that these are spiritual forces of wickedness that are stirring up all the peoples of the earth. And then he says here in that verse 3, and the four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. Now, remember, when John had his vision in Revelation, he was talking about, I believe in chapter 13, he was talking about how he saw this beast coming out of the sea. And the beast with the seven heads and ten horns, and there was kind of a composite beast that we'll get into in just a second. But it's interesting that in the midst of all this turmoil, and in the midst of all this confusion and this world hatred and everything else that's going on, I don't care whether it's all the racism and the riots and the tumult, all of these things, the beast comes out from the middle of this. And what Daniel sees is the first beast he sees, he says, the first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle, and I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. Now, we know that this lion represents none other than Babylon. As a matter of fact, even in the ancient ruins of Babylon, which Babylon has actually been reconstructed and rebuilt by Saddam Hussein, but on the ancient walls of Babylon, they actually had pictures of lions with wings on them. That was kind of like their symbol. And he's saying here that this particular lion had the wings of an eagle, and then eventually these wings were plucked off. Well, these wings of an eagle, I think this is really significant, because if you look at what Daniel is seeing, he sees this lion with his wings on it. And the wings, obviously, they represent speed, they represent swiftness, they represent how Babylon made its conquest so quickly and dominating the world around it. And a lion is really known for its ferociousness, its savageness. I mean, its ability to rent and to tear and to cause intimidation and trembling, this type of thing. This is what Babylon was noted for. But then after Babylon consolidated most of its conquest of the known world, it kind of kicked back a little bit. And it says its wings were plucked. In other words, it no longer went out and expanded its conquest. But it says a human mind was given to it, and it stood erect like a man. And I've mentioned this many times before. Babylon became synonymous with Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar became synonymous with Babylon. The two became one. Just like exactly what you see when Nazi Germany, we had Hitler and Germany, the two became one. This man, you know, represented this kingdom, and this kingdom represented this man. But then, after that kingdom, he says he saw another kingdom arise, which he describes in symbolic language. Now, again, look at the contrast between what God sees and what man sees, what the natural man sees. When Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, he didn't see this fierce lion with four wings on it. He saw this head of gold, something great, something magnificent. This world domination, this world, force. He saw it as something great, something to look up to, something to be admired. When God looks down on it and sees that it's just a beast. And we can see this. Unfortunately, so many people throughout the world do not comprehend this. Mm-hmm. That we are even told in Ecclesiastes that men are but mere beasts. And God will allow men to just continue on in their destructive ways until they eventually begin to come to that realization. For so many years, I have said that in each individual, there really isn't any good thing. Like Paul says, in me dwells no good thing. One of the biggest deceptions that Satan has pulled upon mankind is for mankind to think that they are basically good. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that a person will be able to look at themselves straight in the eye and say, you know what, there's no good in me. And consequently, I need salvation through another means than trying to be good because there's no good in me. Mm-hmm. And once you see that, you'll see your need for salvation, you'll see your need for Jesus Christ, and you see your need for a transformation. But as long as the devil can blind nations and men into believing that they are basically good, they're never going to see their true condition as God sees them, as beasts. Verse 5. And behold, another beast, the second one, resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, arise and devour much meat. Now, this we know, this ponderous bear was known as the Medo-Persian Empire. This is the one that came into being right after Babylon fell. Now, Babylon never was totally destroyed. Babylon was just overrun, and the Medes and the Persians took over under Cyrus and under Darius. They took over the world domination. But it's portrayed as a bear. And it's a bear that's up on one side, like it's ready to strike, but it's got three ribs in its mouth. Now, I've read different commentaries that say, well, these are three different Babylonian cities, and they talk about Babylon as being one of the ribs. I don't think it's one of the ribs simply because during the days of Belshazzar, Babylon had not been destroyed yet. So it's probably some different cities, Borsippora, and there might be a couple other cities that Medo-Persia had conquered from the Chaldeans. But Babylon hadn't been destroyed yet. But the fact that the bear is up there on one side showing that it's ready to strike shows that it's going to strike during the time of Belshazzar, which it did. It struck Babylon and then it was destroyed. And it says, arise and devour much meat. Well, a bear, symbolically, I mean, the symbolism of bear, I think is very significant because it's what? A bear is a very, very powerful, ponderous animal. It's not as swift as a lion by any means, but I tell you, it can run things down if it wants to. You don't ever want to get in the way of an angry bear. I mean, there's no hope for you. I mean, a bear can rip, its claws can rip anything apart. It's amazing. And they can tear into anything if they're determined to do it. I mean, this is how powerful a bear can be. Well, this is what was kind of portrayed by the Medo-Persian army. It was ponderous. It was huge. It was powerful. It could rent and tear and destroy and consume everything in its path. And that's exactly what it did under the Medes and the Persians. You know, that lasted, I mean, from about 580 B.C. to 333 B.C., the Medes and the Persians' domination. Babylon, of course, was around from 605 B.C. to 530 B.C. Now, Daniel sees another beast. In verse 6, he says, and after this I kept looking, and behold another one, like a leopard, which had on its back the four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Okay, now this is none other than Alexander the Great. A leopard is an animal that's very, very fast on its feet. It's very, very swift, and it's a very, very powerful animal. Well, this was represented by Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great, he was only a young man. He was like in his early 30s when he died, but he conquered the whole known world. I mean, history tells us that when he wept because there was no more worlds to conquer. That's how fast he conquered the world. I mean, there was nothing that could stand before him in his armies. And he said he had four wings. Alexander the Great had four generals that eventually, when Alexander the Great died, his four generals split up his kingdom. And that's what's referred to as the four wings, because if you look at the leper, I mean, he had four generals. I mean, one of them was Cassandra, the other one was Cephas, the other one was Ptolemy, and another one was Lomachus. And they split up his kingdom after Alexander the Great died. I mean, Cassandra got Greece, and Asia Minor, including Syria, went to Cephas, and Ptolemy got Egypt, and Lomachus received the eastern section of Alexander's kingdom when he died. So you see this beast and what it represents. Interesting, the Bible talks about leopards. It says, can a leopard change its spots? Meaning that a leopard can't really change its nature. And in the context, when God asks that question, he's referring to Israel's base nature, that they need a complete transformation because their nature needs to be changed. Well, you see this in the leper, that this is a beast represented by selfishness, self-will, rebellion, sin, that type of thing. Well, then he says here in that verse 7, and after this I kept looking in the night visions. Now, again, the spiritual darkness that engulfs the world, and he keeps looking and looking and looking. And somewhere down the line, many years, actually centuries, a few thousand years later, he sees this next kingdom. This next kingdom is about to come into prominence. I mean, we are at the very threshold of this next kingdom, you know, being revealed, because it says here, I kept looking in a night vision as behold the fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong, and it had large teeth of iron. Now that coincides with when Daniel had seen this huge stature of man, he had legs of iron. Okay, and this represented Rome. And Rome actually ended up being divided into two, divided into east and to west, as far as Rome was concerned. But Rome just kind of fell from within. It was it wasn't really conquered. I mean, it was overrun by barbarians at one time. But I mean, it just fell apart. But then it's going to be revived in its last days. Mm-hmm. And this particular beast has, he says, teeth of iron, and he refers to this beast as having a. He says, they kept looking at visions. Behold, the fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong. It had a large iron teeth. It had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And verse 8, he said, while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up from among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boast. Now he sees this fourth beast. This fourth beast is the fourth world power that's going to dominate the world. And this fourth beast, like I said, is very on the very threshold of you know, coming into existence or prominence. This fourth beast, he doesn't just give a lot of description about it, other than the fact that it's got 10 horns on it, it's got teeth of lions, and it crushes and devours, and it's a kind of a composite beast, which shows that it has, you know, the ferociousness of a lion, the strength of a bear, it has the swiftness of a leopard. It's composited in these different aspects of this fourth beast. Now, before we go any further, it's almost like you have to kind of read this along with Revelation. You don't even have to turn there, but John has a very, very similar vision. Now, I'm just going to read it to you. You don't have to turn there. But in John's in chapter 13 of Revelation, John says this, and I stood on the sands of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its head were blasphemous names, and the beast which I saw was like a leopard, okay? It was like a leopard. It was, again, we see the Alexander the Great's kingdom. And his feet were like that of a bear, the Medo-Persian kingdom. And his mouth was like the mouth of a lion, showing that of the Babylonian kingdom. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. So you see that composite beast that came up out of the sea. This composite beast, it has 7 heads, which represent, I believe, the 7 different... continents of the world. There's 7 continental land masses of the world. I mean, there's North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, and Antarctica. The devil basically has control of the whole earth, mm-hmm. and nothing can stand before it. This is a composite beast of what Daniel has seen up here. This is going to be the last days. This beast here represents this world power that's going to be just so powerful and suffocating and murderous that, you know, God sees it as something that's just needs to be destroyed, annihilated, because this is what happens when men turn from God and they try to build a utopia apart from God. I mean, they just create governments that end up just being murderous regimes that are hell-bent on just destroying mm-hmm. everyone that gets in their way. And we see this time and time and time and time again throughout history. And we can certainly see it today. We can see it with these terrorists. If, you know, given an opportunity, they would definitely destroy the whole world and bring it all down with them. I mean, there's no respect for human life. There's no respect for innocent people. It's just, you know, you see the kind of beast that comes out of people, and then it's magnified in governments mm-hmm. that are run by people. And that's just what Daniel was seeing here. So then what he says here in that verse 8, he says, "While I kept contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And three of the first horns were pulled up by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts." So what we see here is he sees this composite beast here, and he sees this horn coming up from among the ten horns. And as this horn is coming up, he says he's got eyes like a man and a mouth that utters great boasts or blasphemous things. Eyes represent what? Symbolically speaking, eyes represent intelligence, insight, wisdom, understanding, perception. This man that's going to come upon the scene is this little horn. Horns always represent in the Bible powers. Okay? Well, this particular man is going to be none other than the Antichrist. He's going to be the head on the head of this beast. The beast represents his kingdom, but the horn represents the man. As this man comes up, he's going to tear out by the roots three other men, three other kings. All right. I used to think to myself through all of that different reading that I would do, I used to think that these ten horns represented ten kingdoms, but they don't. They represent ten kings. And that even the angel himself that interprets this for Daniel tells us that. They are kings. They are men. So what's going to happen in the last days is there's going to be a kind of Politburo. In other words, there's going to be a kind of 10 politicians. They're going to have a kind of like a 10-man cabinet that's going to be headed by the Antichrist himself. And these 10 men are going to make the decisions for the whole world. These are kings. Maybe they are the head of certain countries, but they are 10 men that we have to keep in mind. The beast itself represents the kingdom that they are going to represent, but it's probably be much more than just 10 kingdoms. So what this really says is that there's going to be probably this whole composite of the European common market, however nations it may include, are going to be run by 10 men. But when the Antichrist comes to power, he's going to come up from among them. He's going to have, he says he rips them out by the roots. Three of them are ripped out by the roots. So in other words, I assume that he's going to have three of these kings assassinated. But I'm assuming that he has them replaced, because never do we go from 10 horns to 7 horns. So they are replaced with people who he feels are more in tune with his ideas of world domination.
What do you mean, never do we go from 10 to 7? I don't understand.
In other words, it says here that that three of these horns are ripped out by the roots. Okay, but then when John keeps describing the beast, it still has 10 horns. And even Daniel, when he's talking about the 10 horns, his 10 horns are still there. Even though three of them have been ripped out, they've been replaced. Those 10 horns represent 10 kings. The reason I say that is because the angel tells us that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, 10 men, 10 kings, 10 politicians, 10 presidents, or whatever we want to use, whatever term you want to use. Three of them are assassinated, ripped out, they're finished. I don't know, you know, what he's going to do with them. He's probably going to assassinate them and then replace them with, you know, his own people that are going to rule the world with. Because it says here, there's kind of almost an interjection here before he goes on to describe this a little bit further. So let's just hold off on getting to that, and let's just follow this chronologically. But verse 9, in Daniel chapter 7, and he says, I kept looking until thrones were set up. So in other words, after this beast, there's going to be another event take place, and he kept looking, suggesting it's further on, much further on down in the realm of history. I've said this many times. If the rapture were to happen tonight, if Jesus Christ were to come tonight, let's just say the whole world ended tonight, there's still going to be another 1,000 years before this next event takes place. And this next event is referred to as the Great White Throne Judgment. Mm-hmm. Because beginning of verse 9, it says, I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. Now, the Ancient of Days is none other than Jesus Christ himself. Mm-hmm. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool, and his throne was ablaze with flames, and his wheels were the burning fire, and a river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were open. He interjects here something that I think is, to me, is the most awesome day in the universe. And as a matter of fact, John, the Apostle John, refers to the same event in chapter 20 of Revelation when he says, and I saw a great white throne and him who sat upon it, from whose presence the earth and the heavens fled away and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead and the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from these things which were written in the books according to their deeds. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every one according to their deeds. And the death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Now John describes in chapter 20 what Daniel is describing here in chapter 7, verses 9 through 10, about this great white throne judgment. Yeah.
He was reading out of Revelation.
Anthony. Oh, he was.
That was Revelation.
Okay.
He was showing a parallel.
Okay.
Yeah. I just went to Revelation 20 because John talks about the same thing. He talks about this great white throne judgment. Now, these drawings that I've made, obviously they're very, very lame. I don't think they could really begin to give you the real concept of what's going to happen here. But nevertheless, I think they're significant because what Daniel is seeing, I think, is so powerful, and what John is seeing is so powerful. I cannot imagine in my mind's eye, I can't imagine a more awesome day than this. This day is going to be 1,000 years from the night or further on. It's going to be at the very end of the Christ's reign after the 1,000-year period. It says that the hell is going to give up the dead souls, the souls that are in them. He said the sea gave up his dead as well as their graves. Mm-hmm. So in other words, everybody who's ever died who's unsaved, their souls are in hell. It's kind of like you're arrested for a crime and you go to jail awaiting your trial. Well, everybody who's in hell is now, in a sense, they're in jail. And they're waiting their trial. Their trial is going to be this great white throne judgment, mm-hmm. where Christ will sit on this great white throne and everyone will be standing before him, and he will judge all these people. There will be billions and billions of people there. Yeah, Rich.
Where are all the saved?
Now, it doesn't tell you where the saved are, but I'm assuming that they are just witnesses to this. They are witnesses to it because we are told in Hebrews that there is a great cloud of witnesses that are watching us in our everyday spiritual walk. And they are really rooting for us. So during this particular time, all of these damn souls will be standing before Christ. But it says myriads upon myriads are ministering to him. So it could be saints plus angels or just angels and others are observing it. But I do believe that the saints are going to have a hand in this judgment because it's not only just the great white throne, but we are told in Revelations, and I think in here too, it says thrones. Plural. Looking at verse 9. Mm-hmm. I kept looking until thrones were set up. So I believe that the saints are going to have a hand in this judgment. They're not just going to be simple bystanders. And the reason I say that is because we are told that
in Corinthians, where it says, "Do you not know that you shall judge the world?" That's 1 Corinthians 6:2. It also says, "Do you not know that you shall judge angels?" That's 1 Corinthians 6:3. In Daniel 7:22, we were just told that judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. So I believe that during this great white throne judgment, there is going to be saints that are going to be on the throne and judging with Christ, because we are going to judge, you know, angels as well, acting as judge. And that's another thing I think the devil just cringes at. But a couple of things to keep in mind when he's describing this throne, because he said it's great. In other words, it's mighty, it's awesome, it's intimidating, it's overpowering. It's just, you know, I don't believe for 1 minute that anybody that's standing in this crowd here is going to have to stand on their tippy toes to see Christ. I don't think anybody's going to have to strain to see what's going on. They are going to see this awesome sight, and it's just so so profound. I mean, the same God that they have ignored, that they have given their collective middle finger to, all these people who have been trying to just get him out of our schools and out of our courts and out of our judicial system, out of our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to be standing before him, and believe me, there's not going to be one person there that's going to feel cocksure of themselves to say, "Oh, well, I'm going to beat this rap." I'm telling you, you know, people are going to be there with their knees knocking together. They are going to be such a terrifying sight to see this the Almighty God. Because remember, when John saw in his revelation, he saw a picture of heaven. He said there was this emerald rainbow around the throne. The rainbow symbolizing mercy, and the emerald symbolizing life, and this type of thing. Well, here there's no rainbow around this throne. This throne is a throne of judgment, and when the people see the fire that's flowing from this, like lava, I mean, it's just going to be terrifying. And some people might think to themselves, well, now how is this going to work? You got billions and billions of lost souls standing before Christ. And well, how are you going to judge each person? Are you going to go, well, next, and for the next 100 million years, you're going to have to wait for each person to be judged? No, I don't believe that for one split second. What's going to happen is God is God, so he can do whatever he wants. He's going to be able to judge every single person individually at the same time, yet everybody collectively, and everybody going to be aware of everybody else's judgment. Mm-hmm. That's awesome to me. That's really, you know, something. I mean, we can't really conceive that, because we can't hold two conversations at one time, let alone billions and billions at the same time. But certainly God is capable of doing that, and at this particular juncture in history, he's going to enable people to have this ability, and that's how he's going to judge mankind. A couple of things to keep in mind, the way Daniel describes it here, he says that it's the Ancient of Days. In other words, he's eternal. He's the beginning and the end. There's nothing before God. There's nothing after. He's the Ancient of Days. He says his vesture was like white wool. In other words, his vesture, his clothing, represents what? His righteousness. In other words, he's totally righteous, totally pure, totally holy. There's not one flaw, moral flaw in him whatsoever. He says his hair on his head was like pure wool. Hair represents what in the Bible?
Crown of glory.
Glory.
Yeah, hair, it represents wisdom. It represents strength. Remember Samson? It represents intelligence, understanding, and his hair is white as wool, pure wool. In other words, not only does it denote his great age, but there's not one impure thought, unholy thought, selfish thought, nothing there. It shows his mind. In other words, not only is his vesture pure white, showing his righteousness, but his hair, showing that everything in his mind as well. He says his throne was ablaze with flame. In other words, this is judgment, his throne. Okay, there's no rainbow here. This is a very, very terrifying sight. And it says here, and its wheels were burning fire. Now, this is something I always had a difficult time trying to comprehend as far as his wheels were concerned. Trying to figure out a throne, what a throne would look like when it has wheels on it. Well, if you read in Ezekiel talked about seeing God above the earth that he had, and beneath him were wheels within wheels, the way he described it. So, going off of what Ezekiel says, I put these wheels within wheels. It almost looks like an atom or something, but it's wheels within wheels. But what's the significance of the wheels? What do wheels kind of symbolize? What do they represent?
I thought they were omnipotent. They had eyes, they were all seeing.
Good, good, good. Because in Ezekiel's vision, the wheels had eyes all the way around them. And around them. In other words, the wheels to me symbolize this. God is not constrained in time. He can go back and forth anywhere in time. In other words, people who stand before him, when he's accusing them of wrongdoing, none of them are going to be able to say, oh yeah, really, prove it. I didn't do that. Because he can go right back in time and show them this is exactly what you did, exactly what you said, exactly what you thought, this is exactly what your motives were, this is exactly what your attitude was. In other words, in this judgment, there's going to be no limitations. He can go past, present, future. He can go back anywhere he wants. The Bible says, hey, every idle word that men shall speak is going to be, they're going to render an account thereof in the day of judgment. The men are going to be judged upon the basis of their deeds, this type of thing. Well, this is what we're going to see at this great white throne judgment. And he says here, a river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. I mean, that to me is just awesome when you think about it. It's just, he's on fire, the throne's on fire, everything's on fire. And believe me, that's got to be a scary, scary, scary thing to witness if you are standing there and you know that you are guilty. I mean, just the sight of this is going to make people want to jump into hell head first just to get away from this terrifying sight. Because it's so terrifying that what is it? What does John tell us in Revelation? He said, heaven and earth flee from the face of him who's on the throne. I mean, look how massive this heaven is. Heavens are. And earth is. I mean, there's no end that we can see to our universe practically. I mean, they can see the outer edges of it. But, I mean, it's like, I mean, we're talking trillions and trillions of light years. It's going to flee from his presence. And the earth is going to flee from their presence, his presence. I mean, this is an awesome looking thing. It says thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. Thousands and thousands were attending him. Probably angels, but also saints, I can imagine. And then it says myriads upon myriads. In other words, there's no way you can count the number of people who are standing before him. These are all the lost. You don't even want to be in that crowd. He says the court sat and the books were open. I mean, this is the day of judgment that, you know, in many respects, I've been longing for. Not because I want to see anybody go to hell, but I want to see this day come more than any other reason that I want the truth to finally come out. The truth to finally come out. I mean, don't you get aggravated when you see people get away with what they get away with because they lie and deceive? They got their lawyers who lie and deceive, and you see so many people who make a mockery of our judicial system because they lie and deceive, and they just completely run into the ground. Truth, well, the truth is going to come out. You know what's going to be one of the most satisfying things to see during that time when the court sits is like the false religions of the world, the cults, all these falsehoods are going to come out. I don't want to see anybody damned, but I want to see truth win out. I want to see truth be vindicated. I want to see Christ be vindicated. I want to see his saints be vindicated. That's what I'm looking forward to this day. It's a comforting thing to know that God knows it all. He knows everything, motives and our attitude, everything. He knows it all, so he's going to be able to judge us correctly. Okay, but it's going to be Christ on that throne judging, because you know, Jesus himself makes it abundantly clear. He said, for just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son also gives life to whoever he wishes. For not even the Father judges anyone, but he has given all judgment to the Son. And that's what he says in John chapter 5. But also he said something about the books being open. We are told that in John. And also here it says the books were open. Now it's just not one book. He says the books, plural. Now, we know for sure that there's a book of life. There's no question about it because that's what John refers to. Mm-hmm. Okay, that there's a book of life. But he also uses the plural. Now, this is speculative on my part, but I also believe there'll be a book of deeds. There'll be a book of omission. Mm-hmm. And there'll be a book of the law. And, of course, the book of life. Now, the book of deeds, this is a thing that people don't get. We are going to be judged on our deeds. In other words, people say, well, you know, I'm basically a good person, and therefore I'm going to go to heaven if I die. And I, you know, and they assume that they're so good, they say, well, judge me on my deeds. But I guarantee you, they're not going to be wanting to be judged on their deeds. They're not going to be wanting to be judged on their deeds at all, because what are their deeds? Their deeds amount to so much selfishness and self-centeredness and everything from lust to greed and so many other things that are portrayed in their deeds. And then a lot of it, what are their deeds? Well, my deed, my big deed in life is I spend 56 hours a week watching TV. That's my deeds in life? I mean, that's going to be the epitaph of a lot of people. Unfortunately, that will be. And I'm not talking about 80-year-old people. I'm just talking about people who are just squandering away the time that's given, God's given to them. That's a scary thought, that they're going to have to account for that. And there's a lot of people like that throughout the world. Anyway, in verse 11 it says, I kept looking because the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. And as for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but by extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. This is almost like a parenthesis. You know, they talked about this great white throne judgment in the midst of everything that he was seeing as far as these beasts were concerned. Now he kind of gets back to the subject of the beast, that he was talking about this, the boastful words of this horn, but he also says that there was extension of life given to each one of these beasts. In other words, they were all given a certain amount of time to rule the world. That, you know, there was a point of time given to them. Like I said, Babylon was from 605 to 530 BC. Medo-Persia was from about 530 to 333 BC. Greece came into prominence about 330 BC to 100 BC. And then Rome took over from there from about 100 BC. And it went on and on and on and on. It was still around during the time of Christ and afterwards, and it's going to be resurrected as a world power under the Antichrist. Okay, but there's a point of period of time for all of these. In other words, nothing catches God by surprise. This is all foretold. It's right down to minute detail. He says here in that verse 13, I kept looking in a night vision, and behold, there was clouds of heaven, and one like the Son of Man coming, and he came up to the ancient age, and he was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all the peoples and nations and men of every language, that every language might serve him. His dominion is everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one, which will not be destroyed. In that verses 13 to 14, he says he kept looking in a night vision. In other words, this is still a situation where there's still demonic influence because of the night vision. Even though at this particular juncture, Christ is about to receive a throne that will be everlasting to everlasting. Now, he'll receive this at the start of the millennial kingdom, but it's actually after the white throne judgment that there'll be a new heavens and a new earth, and then there'll be no more darkness. Well, here it talks about night vision. Remember that after the 1,000-year reign of Christ, Satan, who has been bound for 1,000 years, is loosed for a short period of time, and he goes out and deceives the men on the four corners of the earth, and then there's a rebellion against God that God puts down immediately, and then there's a great white throne judgment. So when he talks about night vision here, it still encompasses this period of time when Satan is not completely finished. He's not thrown into the lake of fire yet. And he says here, one like a Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days. Now, this is what's kind of confusing to me, because we read back here, we're talking about the Ancient of Days and his description. Then we're talking about the Son of Man coming. Well, we know the Son of Man is Jesus Christ. He's referred to no less than 80 times in the Gospel as being the Son of Man. His identification with man was, that made it one of his favorite titles. He was always referring to himself as the Son of Man. So when it says here, the Son of Man comes up to the Ancient Days, it makes it look like this is God the Father on the throne. I think that, it could be. It may not be Christ, it may be God the Father. But here's the thing. Jesus himself said in John chapter 5 that all judgment is given to the Son. So what you see here is God the Father giving to him his kingdom forever. So it's almost like these two are interchangeable. Now, I could be wrong here, but we're dealing with the Trinity. We're dealing with a mystery. We're dealing with three distinct personages in one Godhead. Anyway, he says to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all the peoples of the nations and men in every language that might serve him. His dominion was an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. I mean, that to me is something to look forward to, especially when we look at so much of the corruption in our own government. I mean, let's face it, the United States is still the greatest nation on the earth. And I'm not talking about from a bolster point of view. I'm talking about there's never been a government that has been so uniquely fashioned as our own, with our own constitution, that give men liberty and freedom in spite of all of our faults and our failures and our weaknesses and our shortcomings and our sins and everything else. It's still the greatest nation on earth. In other words, I get so angry with our judicial system because of its corruption, because of so much lying and so these lying, cheating, good-for-nothing lawyers and blood-sucking parasitical drones that are judges and so on and so forth. But still, you don't even want to be tried anywhere else in the world, do you? Because their judicial systems are far more corrupt. So what I'm saying here is that when Christ sets up his kingdom, okay, there's going to be a situation where all this corruption is going to be eliminated, totally and completely. It's going to be a kingdom that's going to be just characterized by total righteousness and truth and basically happiness and fulfillment. We've already spent over an hour on this, and we've only got halfway through it. So I'm going to have to close for tonight and pick up next week, beginning with verse 15 in Daniel 7. I was really hoping to get all the way through this, but obviously it's just biting off more than we can chew tonight. But does anybody have anything to add or any questions or anything before we close?